everybody. Welcome to Wisdom from Our Neighborhood. This is our Lessons from the Road ongoing season with a conversation between Alana, Anila, Hamza, and myself about how we are trying to do work on the road of battling anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and other forms of racism in the country. And so tonight I'm just so happy to be with my three friends. And this conversation is sponsored by Paths to Understanding, which is formerly Neighbors in Faith and the Tracy Levine Center. Our mission is to bridge bias and build unity through multi-faith peacemaking. So tonight, again, we have Alana Suskin, an educator, an activist, a writer. She's the editor of the progressive blog JewSchool.com. She served as an assistant rabbi at Addis Israel in Washington, D.C. She's an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. She reaches across faith traditions to fight Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. Welcome, Alana.
Hi.
We also have Hamza Khan, who's the founder of the Pluralism Project, an organization working to empower everyday Americans, hailing from diverse narratives in our political process. He's worked as a campaign manager and communications consultant in local and national campaigns, and was presented with a Rising Star Award by Politico Magazine. Together with Alana, they founded the Pomegranate Initiative to counteract Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. Hey, Hamza.
Hello, everyone.
And then we also have with us Anila Afzali, who's the founder of MAPS Amen, the American Muslim Empowerment Network. She's an activist, a public leader, and member of the board of the Faith Action Network. Hi, Anila.
Hello there. Good evening.
So tonight's an opportunity for all of us to have some conversation about what we've been doing in response to the murder of George Floyd, participating in the Black Lives Matter movement, and responding to institutional and structural racism in the country in many forms. And so what we thought we'd do tonight is just kind of hear a little bit about what each of us are doing, and then have some time to reflect with each other on the learnings that we're having along the way, and then begin to have some conversation with all of you about what you can do in your context. And so we're just really happy to do that. So Alana, I'd like to maybe start with you. What have you been kind of doing to sort of lean into this Black Lives Matter moment around the murder of George Floyd?
You know, I'll be honest, it's felt very scattered in some ways to me. I feel like I'm doing a little here and a little there. So for example, I belong to an organization of progressive Orthodox rabbis, and we together wrote a statement, which one of the things that I really wanted, which we got in the statement, was a commitment to six actions on it. So we put that out, and we had the rabbis in the Orthodox community sign it, and then, published it. And that's sort of a little thing, although, now, of course, is the part where we have to follow through on the actions. So we're also working on putting together some classes, both internally facing and externally facing, to try and educate ourselves about the racism in our own communities, both structural racism, towards structural racism as a whole in the US, but also, in our communities, we also have African Americans and other people of color who also not only suffer the effects of structural racism from outside of the community, but also within the community. And so that's one of the pieces that we're trying to tackle, is to really educate our community about some of those things. So that's kind of one piece. And then the other piece is, I'm also one of the co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, which is really an organization that elevates Black leadership. And so I'm trying to take a cue also from the Black leadership in the Poor People's Campaign. And, we just had a very large event on June 20th and 21st, which was the mass meeting. So we, participated in organizing for that. And then, we're trying to also focus here in Maryland on smaller events. But the truth is, I would really like to be doing more, and I do feel like I'm not doing enough. I feel like it's been very scattershot, like a little here and a little there. So I kind of am looking forward to hearing what other folks are doing in response, because I feel like I should be doing more.
Anila, would you like to go next?
Sure. So, of course, this is a time of a lot of change, and Alana mentioned how scattered it seems. To me, it doesn't necessarily feel scattered, but it just feels that so much is happening, and it's hard to figure out what to pick and choose and how to be best engaged in the work that we're doing. And that's in part a good thing, because it is long overdue to have this kind of focused attention on the issue that has plagued our country for 400 years. You know, the pandemic that is far greater than the current global health pandemic that we are facing with COVID-19. So in that sense, I'm so happy and inspired to see this much activity on the ground happening all around us. And with respect to sort of what we're doing, just like everybody else, trying to figure out our space in it, trying to, of course, follow the direction of Black-led organizations and Black leaders, but also figure out what space we can carve, particularly within either the Muslim community or with faith leaders and the faith community, and figure out how we can bring people together and provide platforms and opportunities to really hear the voices that we need to be hearing at this time. So this past weekend on Saturday, MAPS Amen was involved in co-hosting an event that was focused specifically on Black women, elevating and acknowledging and recognizing the voices and contributions and injustices suffered by Black women who often don't get as much attention as even Black men in the sort of movement. So that was a Say Her Name event that we did with the Washington Poor People's Campaign took the lead on that, and we were very honored to work with them and work in particular with Black women to put on this kind of event that turned out to be a beautiful rally and a march and a sort of follow-up rally. But we, of course, had agitators show up, some people trying to disrupt the event, and you know, fortunately, we did have the Bike Brigade there. We had white allies in particular, who were willing to put their bodies on the line to really ensure that those people who were trying to disrupt the event were not successful in doing so. And instead, because of the protection that we had and the support from allies, we were able to continue the full program with this amazing lineup of just phenomenal Black women who spoke, who shared their stories, their voices, their poetry, their performances, and then also celebrate Black joy. So it was just a beautiful and very empowering and inspiring and even uplifting event, even as we were calling for justice for Black women. Before that, you know, just like every week, there's been stuff going on. Before that, for June 19th, MAPS was involved in an event to raise awareness about both Juneteenth in general, but then also to help raise awareness about anti-Black racism, even within Muslim communities and other communities, even our own communities. And we've been doing some kind of internal reflection at MAPS to talk about how we can address the anti-Black racism that exists within our own communities. Before that, I was directly involved on June 17th at this event that was mostly trying to bring together faith leaders and some elected officials, and it was called A Moral Response to the Pandemic, Poverty, and Police Violence. So it tried to bring together all of these, you know, huge issues that we are facing and address it from a real faith perspective, a moral perspective, and to bring some voices, particularly Black voices, to help guide us in terms of what should we be doing in response to these triple crises that we are facing and how to be most effective. So that was wonderful to have that kind of event and even have some elected officials on the call who listened to what was being said. And we looked at it at a state, city level, county level, state level, and national level as well. Just a few other things that we've done. MAPS participated in something called the National Day of Outrage, and it was a day to, or it was an effort to try to get Muslim organizations to spend a Friday afternoon during the congregational Friday services to really dedicate that service to raising awareness about racism, about police violence, and more. And we were very honored to have one of our very esteemed scholars, Sheikha Aisha Prime, to be our guest speaker for that event as well. I've been involved with the Reynolds 6, which is a local manifestation of injustice for some people who've been victims of retaliation by the Department of Corrections, and really highlighting the inequities with COVID-19 inside DOC facilities, you know, for prisoners and people who are detained, and trying to bring justice there. We've held press conferences and done other events to try to raise awareness there. There's a lot more, but that's just some of the things that I'll highlight. I also was very honored to be able to give a sermon at a church where we we focus specifically on this issue. And MAPS Amen, along with MAPS, has issued several statements on the specific, the brutal murder of George Floyd and the many others who unfortunately have similarly been victims of either police brutality or violence or vigilante violence that, that has even resulted in murders and killings and loss of life, unfortunately. So those are just some of the few things that we've been doing.
Brother Hamza, how about you? What have you been up to?
Well, to be honest with you, I've been acknowledging that I have a great deal of white privilege as a South Asian American in one of the wealthiest parts of the country, and one of the most educated parts of the country as well. And so for the last several weeks since George Floyd was brutally murdered, I focused my time on listening to African American voices and highlighting within the South Asian community, which my parents come from, and therefore I have that heritage as well, the extremities of racism and anti-Black racism in particular, which have dogged the Muslim community because of South Asian control of many of our mosques going back for several decades. It's a very important part of our conversation as a faith to recognize that we have a great deal of anti-Black racism that has been fostered by South Asian culture in particular within the Muslim community. And so dealing with that upfront and being very honest about that, I think has been one of the very few things proactively I've done rather than listen. And the reason I've chosen to listen is because I can talk a lot. I have male privilege and I have light skin privilege. And I think right now, speaking with a lot of Muslim American leaders who are Black, including one of somebody I look up to a lot, Jihad Saleh, who works at Islamic Relief USA, and that, you know, this is a time for brown leaders to sit down and understand the experiences of their Black brothers and sisters. And Jihad's perspective matters a lot to me in particular because, in addition to being an African-American leader and having worked on Capitol Hill for so many years, he's also a Shia Muslim American. And the Shia tradition of Islam focuses on the issue particularly of injustice. And when Shia Islam first began to emerge 1400 years ago, it came into being under the banner of the Imam Ali because of non-Arab racism by Arab leaders in the Muslim world. And so Iranians, African Muslims, Kurdish Muslims, folks of many different backgrounds who were living in Iraq approached the Imam Ali and asked him to lead from Kufa a true blue Muslim movement to bring back the equity that was promised by Islam. Because the final, in our faith in Islam, we believe that our Sermon on the Mount from the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, had two very important lines. The first line being that no Arab is superior to a non-Arab, and no person who is white is superior to a person who is not white. And well, the only difference that elevates a person in this world is through piety. The recognition that we have fallen very short of that standard, both abroad and here in the United States, I think is very important for the intra-community conversation that we need to have as Muslim Americans, and recognizing the strong tradition of Shiism in championing marginalized communities and individuals who are downtrodden. That is literally the banner of Shia Islam. And I'm saying that as a Sunni Muslim myself, that's an incredibly important thing for us to be thinking about. I spent the last several days listening and reading a book by a woman named Leslie Hazelton called After Muhammad, the Epic Story of the Split of Sunni and Shia Islam. And Leslie Hazelton did her research. She went through the entire, as we say in Urdu, Waqia Karbala, the entire story of Karbala from beginning to end, from the time of the Imam Ali through his two children, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein. These are three individuals, both in Sunni and Shia Islam, we look up to as role models for decency and doing the right thing in the face of great injustice, even at the cost of your own life. And what Leslie Hazelton focused on again, her book, really touched me, which was the commitment of Imam Ali, Imam Hassan, and Imam Hussein in three very different styles of leadership to fight racism within the Islamic faith, rather not the faith, but the Islamic community, and bring people together around the banner of justice at all costs. And so I think the best thing I can do is take a page from the Imam Hassan's book, which was to be quiet and to listen and to courteously advise from behind, and do exactly that, be quiet and listen. So that's basically what I've focused on for the last couple of weeks.
That's really beautiful, Hamza. And I want you to know that Leslie spoke at one of the first large events that I ever helped participate in to counteract Islamophobia. She spoke at that event, and that event sort of changed my life because so many people came. We had 450 people show up to that event, and Leslie spoke beautifully there. So
I quite enjoyed listening to her voice on Audible for 9 hours for that book. I gotta say.
Yeah. She's great. So the journey for me is really in some ways, it's so difficult to respond to anything right now because of COVID. And I feel like so many of the practices that we normally engage in, when there's a big moment like this, like we can't do them or can't do them in the same way. I feel like I'm grasping the world through a window or through plexiglass, and I can't reach out and hold the hands of my partners, and I can't share my heart the same way. And it's very burdensome. So about a year ago in Anacortes, we had a functioning noose hung in a city park, and it happened in July of 2019. And in response to that, you know, I came back actually from a retreat where I was doing some interfaith work and began to work with the first African-American city council person in Anacortes, and went to the city council that night. And the city council had just gotten through listening to this African-American city council person, but they were looking at him as if the noose was his problem. And something that he should just deal with. And the basic argument that they were having in their own heads was that, you know, some things you just are better without oxygen. If without oxygen, they die and go away. And so I came in with my little, you know, clergy collar and my black shoes. And I took them through some of the history of lynching in this country and the reign of terror that it continues to have, and the impact that it continues to have. And I basically made the argument that there are some bacteria that thrive in the absence of oxygen. And so we began a conversation with the city council that ended up in with a city resolution 2060 in Anacortes, where the city council, all but one voted for this, would speak out against hate in Anacortes and would counteract hate speech when it occurred. And as the result of that conversation, we put together the inclusion, equity, and diversity group in Anacortes. And we've spent about 9 months getting to know each other, listening to the stories, and kind of, you know, providing a healing space for some of the people of color in that group, especially to be able to trust the group and kind of get ready to act. And we were just about ready to move into action when George Floyd's murder took place. And yet we were all kind of stymied too. Like, do we want to get people together in a protest and have a problem with all the, potentially spreading COVID-19? And what ended up happening was that some of the young people in town actually got together and decided to put on a protest without reaching out to anybody else. They just did it. And there were protests happening in Seattle. I could have driven down there, but there are 18,000 police departments in this country. And I think we all have to work, you know, on the one that is where we live. And so I showed up, you know, to Anacortes and was there at the protest. And it was beautiful and very peaceful, and everybody was socially distanced and wearing masks and the whole thing. And in the last 5 minutes, we actually moved into the intersection, kind of the busiest intersection in Anacortes, to have 5 minutes of blocking traffic, basically. And about 5 minutes into this, I noticed a car was moving toward me. And I turned and faced the car, and as if to say, hey, dude, I'm here. And the car actually swerved toward me just a little bit, as if to say, you better get out of the way. And so I kind of jumped aside and moved and stepped a couple times. and the car still ran over the toe of my shoe, of my foot, and it didn't hurt me, but it was 8 inches away from really hurting me. And then what happened next was some young people got impacted by that car not going too fast, but there was a person of color kind of right behind me, and I think he was kind of the target, actually. And then a second car moved through the intersection and actually began to pound into the bodies in the intersection, moving them again and again and again, the guy honking his horn, until finally a young woman fell down. And as soon as she fell down, a person of color, a man who'd been impacted multiple times by these vehicles, punched out the back rear window of this car, trying to protect this young woman on the ground. And so I ran over across the intersection, and I sort of disrupted the scene, you know, because people were pretty angry at this guy. And he rolled down his window and he said to me, you know, well, what did I do wrong? And I said, well, you know, sir, you drove your car through a crowd of people and you hit people's bodies. And he said, well, I get to drive where I want to drive. And I said, well, not if there are people in the way. And then later on, he said, you know, and there's several other conversations here, but later on, you know, he said, well, just because some people are mad doesn't mean I don't get to go where I want to go. And I said, sir, you have lots of options. You could have waited a few minutes. You could have turned around and gone a different street. You could have called the police. I said, you made a bad decision today and you could have harmed or killed someone, and you could have been harmed or killed yourself. You made a bad decision today. And then the police department, you know, kind of arrived on the scene and began to focus far too much on the broken glass and not nearly enough on the fact that two cars had been weaponized against human bodies in the intersection. And so it was a lot that went into this whole conversation, but we ended up having a really excellent conversation with the mayor and with the police chief, who in our estimation, and for all this group of folk working on equity and inclusion in Anacortes, we feel like they really are learning and they're really trying. And yet the prosecutor does not want to prosecute the two drivers, because the driver, because the prosecutor is afraid that it would be a bad political move, right? And my argument is, of course, you can't equate the crime of the civil crime of blocking traffic with the crime of impacting people's bodies with your car. And so, it was a very fruitful and emotional, you know, kind of conversation. And we're still going to have more conversation with the prosecutor. But what we think has happened is, in small towns like Anacortes all across the country, there's this sort of notion that we're all nice. And we don't really have any of those problems here. And so we don't really have to respond. And I think what happened when city leaders, when people in the city recognized that two Anacortes citizens drove their cars through a crowd of people, it really kind of cracked open some of the denial we have here. And so while it was really a terrible event, I think the terrible event could turn into really a beautiful movement here. And so it's certainly not the same kind of work that's happening in Seattle, you know, or San Francisco or Minneapolis or Chicago or Detroit or anywhere else across the country, but I think it's important to do the work, you know, here. And so on Thursday night, we're going to have this group meet. We're going to be joining in some of the younger folks, some of the younger leaders that want to join with us. And we're going to begin to really lean into changes in the school system around history, changes in the city around hiring, changes in the hospital around hiring practice, and to lean into some of the changes that need to happen with respect to some police training. And so, you know, I feel like I need to do that work here. And it's been confusing. And I certainly have a lot of powerful feelings about it. I'm not through processing that, but I have learned that, I mean, I've had just a little taste now in this of the disregard of Black lives because as a person with white skin, standing with people with black skin, those two drivers didn't care. They dehumanized our black and brown skin fellow humans and citizens so much that they didn't really care. And I know that that's not the same as what black and brown skin people go through. Like, I know it's just a little teeny taste, but I've tasted it and it doesn't taste good. So I'm still kind of working on that. Do we have any reflections about what each other have done that we'd like to offer, or any questions we'd like to ask each other?
Yeah, I wanted to weigh in. Terry, I know I've talked to you just earlier about the story, so I had heard that already. I'm glad that you and everybody else was okay in the situation. But you bring up two points that I really wanted to touch on or reflect further on. The first one is the point about the burden on people of color, that if there's an issue around racism, the finger is pointed at, or the expectation is that the person of color is the one who should speak about it, raise awareness about it, educate others about it. You know, the whole burden of the problem is placed on the actual victims of the issue that is perpetuated by other people. So that's an imbalance that absolutely needs to be addressed. And this idea that, it, you know, anti-Black racism is not a Black problem, it's a non-Black problem, it's our problem, you know. Racism in general is not a people of color problem, it is a white problem. And we need more allies and people who are directly involved in the perpetuation, whether intentionally or unintentionally, of these forms of oppression, to be the ones to own it, take responsibility for it, and take action to counter it. Because for far too long, we have placed the burden on people of color, Black, Indigenous, people of color, on various issues. So that's the number one point. And I remember King County Council Member Girmay Zahalai, he mentioned that when he was asked about sort of his perspective as a Black man on these issues about defunding the police and everything, and Black Lives Matter, and you know, he essentially gave an answer that, look, I'll answer your question, but I hope you're also asking these very questions to the white council members, you know, who also have a significant role in answering these questions today. So that's the first point that I wanted to point out and reflect on. The second one is your point about the fact that there are 18,000 police departments across our nation. And it's absolutely true that we are seeing this shift in the conversation as part of the movement that has been, you know, again, long overdue. And I'm so happy to see all of the kind of conversations happening now that never happened before, and people who were never, you know, abolitionists about police or anybody who even talked about police reform, now sort of engaging in the conversation about defunding the police. So that conversation, I think, is a new conversation, even though it's long overdue. It's new in our generation about talking about it openly the way we are doing now, even though, of course, there have been in particular Black activists and other people of color who have been talking about this for a very long time, who have been working on it for such a long time. And we, of course, need to you know, gain wisdom from them, learn from them, and follow their lead. But I love seeing this conversation become more mainstream and something that is happening across our country. And the point that I really want to emphasize around this, because I hear this a lot from even people of color and others who are allies of the movement, you know, I hear a lot of the critiques around language. And this happens anytime we have any of these issues, people get hung up on the language. I've heard people say, well, you know what, I really don't like defund the police, let's call it this or let's do this. And I'm like, whoa, it is not our place to tone police or to, you know, police the language around these issues, especially if we are newcomers to the conversation. If we've just showed up, you know, yesterday, and people have been working on this for years and decades, and for us to be able to make that kind of critique is entirely unwarranted, especially if we're calling ourselves allies or accomplices in any way. And the final point that I'll make is just the importance of people, and this is why it's so important for us to educate ourselves, to understand where police departments came from. You know, they were the slave patrols in colonial America. This is the source of the police as an institution. Now, there are good police officers. I'm not saying that all police officers are bad. You know, I know many great police officers, but the issue is the institution. The police, you know, system as an institution is what is problematic, even if there may be, you know, I don't like the language of good apple, bad apple, anything anything like that. It's the institution that's problematic, and we need to defund the institution because that is the only answer in this kind of situation, and actually invest in community solutions to safety and making sure people understand that when people say defund the police, they don't mean that we're going to have no safety, that we're going to have nobody to call if there's some kind of violence or emergency or anything else like that. That's still going to exist. But the idea is we don't need to have these overinflated budgets for police. We don't need to have militarized police. We don't need to have, you know, the kind of weaponry that they have that is really for not the kind of engagements that they have with citizens, but rather for warfare. We don't need that. And what we do need are people who are connected to the community, directly serving the community, doing exactly what we need. And police should never be the ones who are dealing with mental health issues, educational issues, housing issues, homelessness issues. Those are things that can be better handled by others. So I really hope to see more dialogue and conversation around this with people acknowledging our own limitations, particularly in the scope of critiquing the movement when we have, you know, just arrived to the movement.
Hamza, would you like to, oh yeah, go Alana.
Oh, I just wanted to say something very super briefly. To tag on to what Anila said, which is I think she really nailed it when she talked about, like, it's not, you know, an issue of bad apples or good apples. And I think that's really the analysis that the structural racism question comes to address, which is not even just about police, but about racism in general, that we're not talking about individual people that, you know, some people are actually, in fact, racist, and we want them to stop being racist. And some people are trying not to be racist already, but that's not really the issue. The issue is really about the structures in which we live that benefit us, right? It benefits people who are not Black or not people of color. And because we benefit from those, at the same time, it also oppresses people who are in those positions. And it's not about sort of how we feel about things. It's just about the way in which we get that benefit and other people are deprived of that benefit. So I just wanted to sort of like, that really nails the point down, and it's not just police, it's a whole spectrum of issues about race.
Hamza.
I'm not sure what else I can add to that. I mean, I'm actually kind of glad that Anila and Rabbi Alana picked it up as a guy. I'm sitting here going, thank God we have so many brilliant women who can cover these issues well. I can't argue with the facts when it comes to the fact that the police come out of the slave patrols. I can't disagree with anything about militarization of our police forces across the United States. I think that what we have seen in the last seven decades of American political history has been a deliberate effort to turn the 13th Amendment into a way to turn African Americans into a subclass of human beings again in this country. And we've actually, forget the last 70 years, this has been going on since Reconstruction, ever since the South found a way to kind of get back at that. And not to pick on anyone in the room, it's also important for us to keep in mind the role of the Northwest of the United States in white supremacism. Oregon was originally founded. I love Oregon, it's a beautiful place. Yeah. It was originally founded as a haven for whites only. And what does that mean for the Native American tribes and nations that lived there previously? Just, you know, go ahead and take a guess. Keeping in mind our very complicated history about race relations in this country. And, you know, again, not to pick on anyone in the room or not in the room, that just reminds me of the fact that Arab Americans originally petitioned to be declared white rather than being considered people of color in the United States. And that goes back to, again, an issue that's existed in the Muslim community since the time of Muawiyah versus Imam Ali, which is the issue of racial supremacism and the battle that Muslims have had to maintain the Prophet Muhammad's commitment, peace be upon him, to equity of all people, because that is the will of God. So, you know, keeping in mind that we have such a complicated history of race relations in this country, and that each one of us has a heritage that has played a role in this. South Asians, Persians, and Arabs all work together with some Black slave traders to capture and sell Black Muslims from Africa to white slave traders in, you know, the Atlantic slave triangle. How do I think about that as a person who has Arab heritage and has Afghan heritage and has South Asian heritage? Putting it all together for me, and to recognize that I've benefited from like hundreds of years of a privilege that was afforded to me by the slavery of other people is pretty hard for me to accept in my heart and be like, wow, it's just so much more than I can properly digest. The question should go from here of, okay, we've recognized in this conversation the many levels of systemic racism that we have in this country. What are some of the solutions that we're going to be looking at? And obviously, active listening is one, and that's the one that I focus on the most because I need to educate myself more. But in addition to active listening, how do we now, as people who are not Black, all four of us, none of us are African American, how do we now act as allies who can proactively change the future of our country as interfaith activists? How do we take this conversation back to our communities? And that, that takes me back again to recognizing the deliberate efforts of South Asian leaders in the Muslim community to prevent African-American Muslim leadership and to prevent Muslim leaders of a darker hue period from coming up the ranks and helping us build a more unified Muslim community across the country. And of course, Rabbi Ilana can go on. I mean, she has with me privately go on about the many issues of structural racism within the Ashkenazi-controlled Jewish establishment here in the United States, which is where I'm going to stop it, actually, because I think it'd be good, Rabbi Ilana, if you jump in and share that. And what are some plans to help deconstruct that?
You're muted, Ilana.
You want to unmute first, though.
Okay, I do have to unmute first, except for that I should be mute because other people should then talk. The Jewish community is really, I think, having a moment of real self-examination right now. And partly it is due to the efforts of Jews of color who are there's been over the last, I would say, 10 years, a movement to really recognize that, we know, of course, Jews have always known that Jews come in multiple colors, Jews are everywhere, just like Muslims and Christians. But I think in a lot of ways, the sort of the public face of the Jewish community, particularly in the United States, has definitely been Ashkenazi from, from Eastern and Northern Europe. And, if you ask some random person on the street, well, what does a Jew look like? They're going to say a light skinned person with dark hair and, what have you. And I that's been, that's slowly changed, I think, partly because both there's been a movement from Jews of color to be more visible and to take positions of leadership. And also, there's been immigration to this country and there's been adoption. So there are more Jews who are actually, publicly, visibly not white. That on itself, though, it's not enough. And I think we're starting to see people say, look, we really have to recognize that even inside our communities. And it doesn't, it's not just, right or left isn't really a good way to sort of characterize our movements. But even the more traditional movements, yes, of course, there's racism there too, but it's not just limited to that. As liberal a movement as you want to go, and including secular Jews as well, who don't recognize any particular religious feeling, right? All across the board, just like in the rest of American society, it's the moment where we really have to be doing that self-examination. So, Ashkenazi, not Ashkenazi, yes, there's a lot of Ashkenazi Jews in the United States, but at this moment, it's really about facing the fact that we are Americans in that way, that is one way we've assimilated really well, unfortunately. We have absorbed those attitudes, and it's unfortunate. Let's not assimilate that, shall we? The other piece I think that is really coming into play in the Jewish community is the so until recently, Jews weren't always recognized as white, right? Being Jewish was considered a race unto itself, Ashkenazi or not Ashkenazi. If you, even as late as the 80s, there were country clubs that would say, there was one in Bethesda down the road from us, Hansa, no Jews,
sure. Yeah, right? Yeah.
Not allowed. And it only came out because—
I grew up in a community that actually had covenants, and
right.
They were still in the contract saying no Jews, no Blacks, no Iranians. I don't know why that one, and no elephants. That one was very strange.
That is odd.
Yes.
But so, you know, even as late as the 80s, you would, and I think the one in Bethesda only came out because there was a congressperson who tried to join, and it, like, there was a big, woo, you know, yeah. It all came out then. But the sort of the flip side of that, though, is that because Jews have been oppressed as Jews, we often have a really hard time recognizing the privilege that we have as well. Those of us who are light-skinned, you know, obviously if you're a Black Jew or an Indigenous Jew, that's like a whole nother level of intersectionality and problems. But, you know, for those of us who are light-skinned and who might not necessarily be recognized, there's a lot of, you know, I can't tell you how many articles I've seen over the past 2 years talking about, like, Jews aren't white. I'm like, yes, okay, whiteness is not a real thing. It's about how people perceive you. And in this country, light-skinned Jews have white privilege. So it doesn't matter what you think of yourself. And it's true, right, that there's still anti-Semitism. It's not like, you know, oppression has gone away. And certainly outside of urban coastal areas, it's significantly worse. But I think it's a different kind of oppression. And I think that's part of the self-examination that we need to be doing, is to, like, sort of tease out what the difference is between racism and structural racism and anti-Semitism. And of course, they often go hand in hand. You know, people who are white supremacists, if they hate Blacks, they probably hate Jews too. There's not so many people who like one and hate the other. Nevertheless, it affects us differently, and it needs to be analyzed differently. So I guess that's my, like, probably way more than 2 cents.
Well, you know, I was thinking that we have much more complex stories than as a white person. I have a much more complex story than I think I was told as a child, you know, because my family in the 15th century were Moors that were sent out of Spain by Ferdinand and Isabella. It's why I tan up really easily in the summertime, because my ancestors were Moors that were sent out of Spain, were refugees going into southern Germany. But I also have a family member that my great grandpa, who came across the ocean in an 18-foot wooden boat with 12 people, took a great act of courage. He was kind of an economic refugee himself at that point, but he benefited from 600 acres of land taken from the Palouse Indians in Eastern Washington State, land that was never offered to people of color. It was really not offered to non-Christians. My dad himself got an FHA loan. That was a loan program that was not available to people of color in this country. And so as I reflect on my childhood, and I think about the attitudes and the institutions both, it was if you've benefited from the oppression of another people, you have to hate them. You have to dehumanize them to live with yourself, right? And so part of what we need to do, I think, as we start to move toward, you know, what can people do, is number one is to be a little less afraid of that complexity, and to recognize, I think, from our traditions, that God loves and values us enough for us to look at the ways that we've benefited from the unjust patterns and systems. Yeah. And so we'll move into that question. I do want to say one thing about institutional sin and just institutional racism. When I was speaking with the mayor and the police chief, I said, you know, as a person that works to counteract collective blame toward Muslims and Jews and others, I certainly do not want to engage in collective blame toward all police officers. But I said, sometimes when we're talking about institutions and structures and the culture of policing, it can feel like collective blame, but we're really talking about something different. We're not talking about the intentions of police officers. We're talking about the impact of policing, which is a very different thing. And I think that kind of helped them a little bit, because they realized that I wasn't calling them bad. I was inviting them to kind of an institutional or cultural reflection about what policing is and how it functions in our city and how it engages with people of color, especially. And so, but it's all super complex. So what I hear all of us doing is we're doing our own work personally. I hear us working within our own kind of institutions, and I'm doing some of that work within the Lutheran Church as well. participating in it. And then we have work to do in our local communities. So as people who are listening to this or are listening to a podcast later, what are some things that you think folk can do to practically make a difference right now and lean into this moment where maybe we have a chance to really move the dial on institutional and structural racism in this country? Anila, you want to go first?
Sure. You know, I'm always action oriented, so I love this question and always ready with a list of actions folks can take. So thank you for the opportunity. I would say, first off, the education piece is really critical, educating ourselves, and specifically not just as we've discussed on this call, not just the individual forms of racism, but really on the structural, systemic, institutional forms of racism. And specifically, you know, making sure that they understand the history of police and also understand the prison industrial complex, because I think those are two institutions that really uphold systemic racism in our country. So a couple things, you know, watching the documentary 13th is a great one, reading the book The New Jim Crow, reading many other Black authors that have written, you know, very appropriately about this topic and in much detail. But those are just a couple things. And of course, Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist, because it's not enough to just be not racist, as he says. You really have to actively combat racism to be an anti-racist at a time like this. So that would be number one, is the education. Number two would be really supporting and listening to the voices of Black leaders, Black activists who are there on the ground, because that's a critical part. There's been a lot of Black people, people of color, who have written about these issues, but they may not get as much attention sometimes as some of the white authors who might come in and start writing about something. So there's an even imbalance in sort of that structural inequity, even in this issue where we have so many incredible Black voices and Black leaders that are not getting as much attention. So really making sure we support the Black activists and Black leaders with our funds financially, but also with reading and listening to their voices and elevating those voices. Number three, I would say take action in the form of supporting calls for defunding the police or prison reform. And there are many different ways to do this, but specifically at the local level, whatever city folks are in, know that it's the city councils that can take action on this, the mayors, the city councils, who can effectively address the whole sort of police budget. And we can sort of put a list together of all of these kinds of different sources that people can get information about this and make sure that they are in touch with their elected officials and raise these issues and want to see real change in terms of action there. The other thing that I would say is just in terms of perspective, you know, we've talked about the importance of focusing on institutional systemic change and not just individual forms of racism. The other thing that I would say is make sure we have the perspective that's broad enough to understand the interconnectedness of various issues, because anti-Black racism directly intersects with Islamophobia. Even in these areas that I've just talked about, if we're talking about police, we have things like police going and getting trained in Israel, even under what has been called these deadly exchanges, or we have the whole countering violent extremism program that is really intended to focus and target Muslims in a way that then comes back and hurts Black and brown people all over. So these are forms of intersection between these issues, understanding how these various forms of intersection exist and coexist, and really sort of reinforce these forms of oppression. Understanding how issues about facial surveillance technologies or license plate readers or others affect protesters, affect Black people, brown people, others who care about these issues, and sort of affect immigrants with ICE and sort of the way that ICE operates, that's similar to the way police operates. Understanding these connections between these various issues, if we really want to stand as allies and stand firmly for justice and against these forms of oppression that we see. And one of the things that I would say I love seeing right now is the sense of greater accountability, even to those sort of, you know, oftentimes even people of color communities or other marginalized communities, they benefit from proximity to whiteness, you know, proximity to power. And right now we are seeing this form of accountability across the board, and that's something positive. And I hope more people learn a little bit more about that in the sense of accountability and proximity to power and sort of how that reflects in individual actions and collective community actions as well. The other things are just a couple things that I'll mention, at least specifically for the Northwest area or for Washington State. There is an effort, and this is to create some kind of institutional change. There is an effort to try to bring back affirmative action that has been banned in our country. We've talked about all of these inequities, like the ones, Terry, that you mentioned, your family benefited from, so many other white families have benefited from, and many Black families have intentionally been deprived of access and funding and power and everything else. And there are efforts right now to try to address that. So in Washington State, there is an initiative, it's Initiative 1776. So if people go to yeson1776.com, they can learn about ways to get engaged and support that initiative here in Washington State. There are other efforts as well locally, like to try to get 1,000 homes in the Central District, which was historically a place of a lot of our Black siblings living there, and that because of gentrification and intentional efforts to push them out, they have been pushed out. So trying to address affordability and housing and homelessness and all of these issues collectively, there's a lot of efforts happening right now, and we can include these in the sort of follow up in the comments or whatever, but ultimately we need to find these ways to really change the imbalance. And the way that I describe sort of affirmative action and the need for it is because for so long there has been a monopoly game that has been going on where people of color, specifically Black people, have not been allowed to pass go and get money. They've been charged every time at every turn, while others have been building houses and hotels even. And now this game board is completely imbalanced. And you can't just say, well, hey, the rules have now changed, you're allowed to now buy houses too, when it has been completely lopsided. To address that structural inequity, we absolutely need reparations. So we need folks to really call for this and really change the conversation, so we start challenging the institutional systems that perpetuate racism individually, collectively, and as a sort of countrywide level. Those are just some. I have many more, but the census, of course, too, and voting. I'll mention those two.
Preach it, sister. Alana, how about you?
I feel like Anila has really covered a lot of the ground that I would want to cover. So, kudos to you, Anila. I would just sort of focus in on two really small things. The first is, I really liked how you made a point about talking about how all of these issues are intersecting with one another. And I do want to sort of give props to the Poor People's Campaign for forming their platform on that idea, right? So yeah. The Poor People's Campaign really focuses on the connection between poverty, structural racism, militarism, and the environmental degradation. And then, of course, also about the completely degraded moral dialogue that our countries have, that, whether it's talking about white supremacy or failing to talk about poverty, and all of those things are really inseparable. You know, you can't talk about the environment without talking about how poor people live with open sewage in their front yard or, incinerators in their backyard. You can't talk about structural racism without talking about, how people are shunted into the military as an only option out. So all of those people, all of those pieces come together very neatly. And I, Anila did say that. And so, but I just want to kind of say, let's encourage people to get involved with the Poor People's Campaign so that they can actually take action as part of a larger movement. And the other piece I would say is just the organization Campaign Zero, which focuses on police brutality. It has very specific things, data-driven, about how to address police brutality. It doesn't go quite as far as defunding, which I think we also need to be talking about defunding. But I think it's also important to look at those specific data-driven steps. And I want to encourage people to go and look at their website, Campaign Zero.
But before we go to Hamza, I'm just going to say that Joseph Campbell, I was recently reminded, said that if you want to change the world, you got to change the metaphor. And I heard today a police chief from Memphis say that the only thing between civilization and no civilization is the thin blue line, is the fear that people have of police. And that metaphor is completely wrong, because we know that there are lots of things that are necessary to maintain the shalom, the salam, the peace of a community, which includes you know, housing and food and clothing and a meaningful job and safety. And there's many different aspects that make that up. And I think if we could all work on challenging the metaphor of the United States as one large penal system, and as police, as warriors, and turn them, as the Obama administration suggested, into guardians, and then provided many other kinds of services, including reparations to those that have not benefited from federal tax dollars and from land that they were given. But I'd like to turn it over to Hamza now.
So, wow, you guys, like, you always give it to me when there's almost nothing left to say, except there's still so much to say. I want to start with highlighting something actually about Seattle. There is a fantastic author from Washington State named Jamie Ford, who writes about Asian American history, in particular in his novels, focused around the city of Seattle. And one of his novels, I'm forgetting the name now, focused on the experience of Japanese Americans and their relationship with their fellow East Asian Americans of different backgrounds during World War II, and the forced evacuation that Japanese Americans went through during World War II, and the resulting loss of their property, their homes, their businesses. And of course, Congress did in the end provide some level of reparations in the 1980s, which was to the, I think, the tune of $20,000 at that time, which is maybe around almost $100,000 today. People lost literally everything. And no amount of money will make that up. Same thing for our brothers and sisters from Africa who were brought, our brothers, indigenous peoples who lost their homes across the United States and their families and their entire civilizations. But I strongly encourage those of you who are in Washington State joining us tonight to read Jamie Ford's books and educate yourself about the very complicated and painful history of Asian Americans living at a time before we had these conversations in Seattle, so that we recognize when we talk about reparations, we are talking about far more than just one group of Americans. We're talking about many groups of Americans who've been struggling with these issues. And as a society that is now moving towards justice slowly but surely, now is the time for us to keep in mind that justice is never served if it is given in a paltry, partial form. That being said, I'd like to focus on probably one of the most important things that happens in America, the routinization of elections. We have elections every single year for all sorts of odd jobs that you wouldn't imagine should be elected. In one part of Massachusetts, you will vote for every 2 years at least 53 different jobs in a small township somewhere. That is a lot of people who you have to vote for, and so I would really hate to see that ballot, especially right now in the age of everyone wanting to run to stop Donald Trump. But in the conversation about police brutality and structural racism, it's important to remember that most of these cases are handled when it comes to criminal matters at the state and local level. And almost every state jurisdiction has nonpartisan elections for judge. Here in Montgomery County, in Maryland, where Rabbi Alana and I are, we recently had a social justice, racial justice warrior named Marilyn Pierre defeat a sitting judge to end up in the ballot in November. She was campaigned against ruthlessly because she's African American of Caribbean background. And she ran twice. This is her second time, and she overcame huge hurdles in a county that is 52% not white to end up on the ballot properly. And so we're all hoping Marilyn pulls it off because she would add a level of cultural competence to our courthouse, which is sorely lacking. As Anila is an attorney, she can probably not, as I say this, if you end up a local judge, oftentimes you weren't the one who did the best in the bar exam, and you probably didn't do that pot on the LSAT either. So you end up having a level of justice that is completely unfair in the United States at the state and local level towards people of color. Because oftentimes judges benefit from good old boy networks to control local bars, county bars, as in bar associations, not the place where you get drunk. And as a result, those bar associations work to make sure their favorite members end up on the bench and have sweetheart deals with either prosecutors who have to come in front of them or defense attorneys who have to come in front of them. You see where I'm going with this. The point is that if you care a lot, you need to pay attention to these local elections, particularly for judge. Those are the people who are abusing the 13th Amendment and sending innocent people to jail simply because they don't like them. That's something you have to think hard about as Americans every single day. Unless we fix our justice system, this is a big part of the Islamic faith. If there is no justice in a civilization, Islam believes that that civilization does not exist. That was a big lesson that the Imam Ali, Imam Hassan, and Imam Hussein, all three of them taught, in addition to their spiritual elder, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them. So take it seriously. You must vote. If you are an attorney of color, you should run for judge wherever you are. Yeah. People like us will come up, and I mean, obviously, I'm a person of color. I will be happy to help you. I know Rabbi Alana, and I know Terry will step up to the plate too, because it's those judgeships that we need to turn over in the United States immediately for us to fix the problems that we're facing today. Same thing with state prosecutors and local prosecutors, and same thing when it comes to local legislatures. It's not a glamorous job to go out into the state capitol and, you know, spend a lot of time doing something that doesn't pay a lot of money, but 75% of the laws we deal with in America on an everyday basis are laws that are made by states. And as Alana and I can tell you, here in Maryland, we have a lot of really arbitrary laws that result from people not participating in their state government, which is partially on purpose because we can't even watch our state government make laws in Maryland online or on TV. They actually have stopped that bill a bunch of times. This is what happens when we focus more on MTV and Netflix and chilling with those both, whatever that means to you, and not chilling in government and making a difference at the local level in elections. So before democracy goes the way of democracy in Pakistan, which means it doesn't exist, do yourselves a favor and actually participate. This is very key. If you want to save this country, protests are great. It's a First Amendment, right? You know how the First Amendment goes away? You pass a bunch of laws and 3/4 of the states of America agree in passing that law. And then we wouldn't have a First Amendment anymore. Therefore, go out and vote so that people like that do not take advantage of our system any longer, and we no longer have Donald Trumps, and we no longer have Jared Kushner's behind the scenes. That's my spiel tonight.
So I just want to thank both of you and also Anila. Anila had to run off to her 8 p.m. Zoom meeting, but I'm just so thankful for the conversation tonight and for knowing you all. And I just want to say, as we've recently had a hate crime here in Skagit County, and we have a prosecutor that doesn't want to prosecute it, because he wants things to go back to normal. Well, yeah. We don't need things to go back to normal. We need things to go forward to justice, right? And so there's going to be a lot of pressure on him by a lot of people in this county to step up and to realize that the biggest stain on the county is not that some hate crime happens here. The biggest stain on the county is if a hate crime happens and we do nothing about it. That our elected leaders, our prosecutors and so forth, do not step up to protect people who are citizens of this country. So I'm just so thankful to be part of this conversation. We'll all be back in a month or so to continue this conversation. You can learn more about Paths to Understanding at paths2understanding.org. And Alana, do you all have a website for the Pomegranate Initiative yet?
Working on it.
Okay, you're working on it. So we look forward to sharing that sometime soon. We want to remind you that Challenge 2.0, hosted by Jeff Renner, is on our YouTube channel, as are all of these. We're just launching our new Paths to Understanding podcast, and so you can check out these and all of our episodes there, and encourage all of you to be well, be calm, and be good to your neighbors. Thank you for listening.